Today's episode is brought to you by Musical Theater Radio's merch store. Looking for that perfect gift for someone or just want to treat yourself to some great musical theater themed merch? Head to musicaltheaterradio.com and click on the All Things Theater button on the homepage and check out all the different designs available. And now, today's interview. Welcome back to another episode of Be Our Guest here on Musical Theater Radio. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. To say today's guest likes to stay busy is an understatement. He's been a musician, a theater critic, spent many years as the creative director and senior VP at the Drew Jameson Theater, the artistic director of the New York City Center's Encore series, been a creative consultant on many shows, a producer, taught at Tisch School of the Arts at NYU, and as well an author. And in April of 2024, his new novel, Broadway Melody, hit the virtual and brick-and-mortar shelves. The book spans multiple decades of Broadway history and the intertwining lives of Vincent, Aurora, and Ike. It's my pleasure, great pleasure, to welcome Jack Vertel to the program. Jack, hello.
Hello. It's a great pleasure to be welcomed in such a generous way, I must say. I just think of myself as someone who doesn't like to be bored, not someone who likes to be busy.
You definitely cannot be bored. Man, you packed a lot of stuff into your life. And we could probably spend like days talking about everything you've done. Today we want to talk about this new novel of yours. But before we get to that, I always like to ask for a 30-second bio. Now, I gave a lot already away in that opening. But just 30 seconds of... Who is Jack?
Well, I'm someone who grew up in the theater without being part of the professional theater. My parents started taking me when I was 5 years old, and they were in one way or another associated with the theater, as was my grandfather. So I always sort of felt like, oh, this is the world that I need to grow up in. I had no idea how to get into it or what my role in it might be. And that took, you know, most of getting into my adulthood to figure out. But, you know, since then, I've always just wanted to take a job and learn something and then try to use that something. And frankly, I wasn't interested in that much else. It was really like I was interested in the theater and briefly the movies in the 70s. But, you know, it was a great era for movies in the 70s. But my life has basically been the theater. I got married at 23 to a woman who loves the theater. We've been married 50 years. It's a nice life.
You almost had no choice whether to go into
I always say to people, my parents, my grandmother took me to Peter Pan and ruined my life. I mean, that was it.
Which version of Peter Pan did you see?
Mary Martin at the Winter Garden.
Can't go wrong with that one.
Yeah.
Nice. So yeah, like I said in the opening, you've done a ton of stuff in your life with theater. What was the inspiration for writing this novel? You've done all this stuff. You have written other books. What was the inspiration for writing Broadway Melody?
Well, the first book I wrote about theater is called The Secret Life of the American Musical. It was a nonfiction book that grew out of my teaching at NYU. And it was about musical theater structure. It was also sort of a memoir in a way, and it was supposed to be fun, not didactic, but it was nonfiction. I mean, everything in it, I think, is actually true. And when I got done with it, I thought, but my agent said, you know, you should write another book. And I said, yeah, I think I should. I love writing. I mean, I love the process of the writing. And a couple of suggestions were made to me, like, you know, a celebrity biography or a research book on the history of the early musicals. And I thought, you know, I'm just not that interested in that. But this partially goes back to what I said about myself earlier. I have stories and knowledge because of my grandfather, who I never met, but who I learned a lot about growing up from my father. And my father, who had a play produced on Broadway in 1937, you know, I had a lot of lore about the theater, and I really wanted to write about it. And I thought this should just be, I should write a story about it, because frankly, I don't want to do these other kinds of books. But I didn't have a story. So what I had one thing, and then I had another thing, and that's what made the book. The first thing I had was a very good friendship with a man named Seymour Red Press. Red Press was he was still playing by the time I knew him. He was a reed player, saxophone, flute, and clarinet player. in the Encores Orchestra, but he was 80 something. He had been his first gig, I think, as a Broadway musician was in the original pit of the original production of Gypsy in the late 50s. So here he was in 2010 or something. He finally gave up playing in somewhere in his mid 80s, but he was a contractor. His job was arranging the musicians for a Broadway show. I didn't even know that there was such a thing as a contractor when I first came to Encores. But he was not only a great person and a great musician in his day, he was full of stories about early Broadway, what that was like, what his life had been like before Broadway when he was in big bands. And I thought, well, there's a character here. You know, I don't know what happens to him, but there's a character here. And then at the same time, more or less, there was a woman in the ensemble at Encore. She was a soprano, and she did not have big acting roles in the shows, but she was a wonderful, wonderful singer and a very, you know, attractive personality, lovely person to spend time with. And she announced at one point that she was leaving the ensemble to go to Germany and get married. And I said to her, "That's interesting. What happened?" And she told me this story about how she was playing the lead in Phantom of the Opera in a German tour of Phantom of the Opera. And the spotlight operator fell in love with her merely by shining his spotlight on her. He never said a word to her. The first thing he basically said to her was, "I'm in love with you, marry me." And he had been following her with his light all around the stage. And I thought, oh, that's the story. You've got two men and one woman. And of course, this Phantom of the Opera story probably happened in the mid 2000s, but I stuck it back into the early 60s. And it becomes, I mean, a kind of a who gets the girl story. But, you know, the character based on Red Press, not to give away the ending of the book, gets the girl eventually, but by that time they're in their 90s or 80s or 70s or something. And so it allowed me to tell the whole panoply of stories about Broadway and Times Square and all of the things that happened there from about 1960 onward, and even some stuff that happened long before that, through these three characters and their romance. And wow. I thought, that's the book I want to write. So I wrote it. There was a pandemic, which helped.
As bad as the pandemic was, in many ways, it was wonderful for a creative to build.
Yeah. And
so yeah, when you said you started, when did you start writing it then? Down.
I don't remember, to tell you the truth. When was the pandemic? we left.
Block that out. 2020.
It was in March of 2020, I think, the Broadway closed down. Is that right? And we were in rehearsal for a very obscure musical at Encores called Love Life, written by Alan Lerner and Kurt Weill. And it's almost never performed. And we were doing it, and we were at the last day of rehearsal in the rehearsal room before we moved on stage for tech rehearsal. And at lunchtime of that day, we were informed that the production was being canceled and that Broadway was shutting down that night. And so there was not going to be any production of Love Life. And we all kind of got together over this lunch hour and said, well, what we planned for the afternoon was to do a full run through of this show, because it had all been rehearsed in separate rooms and no one had really seen it. And he said, but is there any reason to do a run through of the show since we're never going to perform the show? And everybody said, yes, let's see this once before, even though it's a lot of work for the actors and they have to sing out and, you know, act, and all the designers were in the room and everything. And so we did Love Life once for ourselves in a rehearsal room. And then I got in a car with my wife and we drove to Maine, where we have a house. And we said, well, we'll wait this out for 2 weeks and we'll come back. And, you know, we were there for 2 years instead.
Yeah. That's crazy.
It turned out to be a very good place to write.
Yeah. I love the sort of, just go back with the inspiration. I love those stories because, you know, fact is, you know, crazier than fiction. You know, you couldn't write that, and you know it was there, and you know, the falling in love with the spotlight and with the woman on stage. I love that concept, and you know, you have it in the book and that sort of thing. So was there any inspiration from your own real life that you threw into the book? You've got a couple of these, you know, you got the basis for the book, but what did you throw of your own in there?
Well, there are any number of incidents in the book that are things that actually happened to me. It wasn't about, you know, the deep, dark psychology beneath my cheerful exterior. Yeah. It was actually, I wanted to write a yarn about people. Mm-hmm. And so I clipped events from life. There was a time when I was anxiously trying to buy a ticket at the box office. And the woman in front of me was a very aggressive, kind of difficult person who was having an argument with the box office treasurer as we were getting closer and closer to curtain time about why he wouldn't take her personal check. And finally, I tapped her on the shoulder and I said, I'll take your personal check and I'll buy the tickets. I don't want to miss the overture, you know. No. And she said to me, well, what if the check bounces? And I said, if the check bounces, I will have taken you out to the theater. So, you know, and that happened. And it became a kind of way that two characters who become romantically entangled, at least for a while, meet. And things like that came from my own experiences, I started wandering up and down Broadway in 1962 when I was 13 years old. And my parents, who were, you know, theater fans, encouraged this in every way. And New York was not a particularly dangerous place in those days. Times Square had yet to become, had yet to fall as far as it was going to fall. And so I would wander up and down the streets, memorizing where the theaters were and what their seating capacities were, and buying a single ticket in the balcony to see all of these obscure plays that I didn't know anything about. I think the first one I bought a ticket for was a play called Gideon by Patty Chayefsky that, you know, no one remembers, but I saw it from the last row of the balcony of the Plymouth, now the Schoenfeld. And I just sort of sank myself into this world. And I thought, one day, maybe I will actually, these will actually be the streets of the neighborhood that I work in. And that happened. And, you know, it happened through luck and magic. I mean, I don't know how it happened, but it happened.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, that, you know, you said you were wandering the streets of New York in like the 60s, you know, and you're still in New York doing stuff. I love how the characters, and there's going to be a two-parter, the characters see the arc of theater and musicals through that time. And you've seen, yeah, you know, the arc of theater. What have you seen change from the 60s that your characters saw all the way up to now, that arc of musical theater?
Oh, so many things, both technical things and I guess you would say socio-political things. You know, in the 60s, I started going in 1962, basically all musicals were the same as all other musicals, not in terms of content, but there were tired businessman musicals like How to Succeed in Business and A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And there were somewhat more serious musicals like West Side Story. But they all used 24 musicians to 28 musicians, depending on which theater they were in. They all had the same kind of sound and orchestration to them. They almost all had a love story at the center of them. And it really was a boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl thing that audiences were going to see and that they expected. What happened over time was, a bunch of different things. But one of them was, and I think it's the most interesting to me part of what the theater looks like today, is people, audiences liked musicals. And they liked musicals as more and more of the audience became a tourist audience and less percentage-wise was a New York audience. Mm-hmm. Musicals became more and more the thing to do. And then there was some bravery involved on the part of the artists and producers in that they began to write musicals on much more serious subjects, much more diverse subjects. And it's finally has gotten to the point, I think, where anything can be a musical, and many things that are musicals would have in the 60s and 70s been plays. Fun Home would have been a play. Next to Normal would have been a play. They wouldn't have been musicals. It wouldn't have ever occurred to anybody to write a musical like that. Now it's you know, a wide, wide spectrum. And one of the really delightful things about that is that you can now walk up and down those very same streets that I used to walk up and down and see experiences available to audiences that are nothing like each other. They're niche experiences they have very big niche audiences, but they are sort of niche experiences. And you can see Kimberly Akimbo on one night and Back to the Future on the next night and The Outsiders on the next night. And, you know, they're so very different from each other. A lot of them are developed in off-Broadway theaters or regional theaters around the country, which means they're physically small. And one of the things that's happened is producing has gotten so expensive that orchestras have gotten smaller and smaller. And of course, part of that has to do with the fact that rock and roll invaded the American popular music world in the late 50s and early 60s. And that has now been the music of America for half a century or more, whereas show tunes were the music of America for the half a century preceding that. So it's all very different. If you miss the old time shows, which I do, we had encores. At encores, that's exactly what we did. We presented those shows with full orchestras and full choruses, and you could hear what Fiorello sounded like in 1960 or Of the I Sing sounded like in 1930. Mm-hmm. But that's what's on Broadway now is so very, very different from that.
Oh, I love the encores concept, just as a side note, because on our radio station, I play everything from, today back to, Gilbert and Sullivan and, that obscure 1963 Broadway show that nobody saw, but it had a great cast recording, right? And I
saw it. I don't even know what it is, and I bet I saw it.
I was thinking of the Buddy Hackett one, Ball.
I Had a Ball.
Yes. That was the one I was thinking of when I said that.
But, I can even sing a couple of songs from it if you'd like, but you wouldn't like.
But I love that stuff because, you need to recognize the past to move forward. These shows and songs are lost, unfortunately, through time. And I'm glad, the Encore series is around to, remind people of, there's a lot of good stuff. That you might be missing out of if you're only listening to Hamilton and Dear Evan Hansen and that sort of thing.
So in the book, I wanted to actually track that change. And one of the interesting things that was true of Red Press himself, who was a real person, was that he was music contracting shows like Guys and Dolls and Gypsy and, all these shows. And then suddenly he was hired as the music contractor for, Passing Strange and Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. And he was this old guy sitting in the back of the theater, with these scores that were from Mars, as far as he was concerned. But he loved doing it, and he loved hearing them, and he loved, he knew the world was changing around him, and he didn't particularly change with it. But he said, "Let it change. I'm not backing out. I'm not disappearing."
I like that.
And so all of that is tracked through, the whole story of Times Square's, the glamour of the 40s, the sort of collapse of the late 60s, the themization of and Disneyfication of it in the 80s and 90s and up through now. It's all grist for the mill.
You literally went into the question I was going to ask because you painted an interesting picture of New York City, from that time up till now, the glamour and the glitz of the golden age, the 70s, the 80s, and the Disneyfication. And for someone who either wasn't old enough to see a lot of that stuff, or geographically, I didn't get down to New York until 2001 or something like that for the first time. What was that like, from a personal experience seeing that? Because I know the characters, hearing what they thought of it, and is obviously the characters of your mind, projected through them. But what was that like seeing that change?
It was very difficult to accept for me. Mm-hmm. I liked the old Times Square, and it was very hard to start not liking it because by the time I got there in 1960, it was already not nearly at its height. I mean, it's the height of glamour of Times Square was probably in the 20s and 30s, maybe the 40s. It had begun to get seedy, but it hadn't gotten dangerous and it hadn't gotten horrifying. It had just gotten seedy. And I sort of loved the seediness of that. You could get a slice of pizza for 15 cents and you could get a pastrami sandwich for $1.85. And the quality wasn't great, but you could eat and you could buy a theater ticket to go. It had a kind of romance to it. Mm-hmm. And then over time, when these things are happening on a day-to-day basis, you don't really sense them because they happen so slowly. And B, you give up your affection for them very slowly, I think. But by the 70s, and particularly into the 80s, there were two big things happening that really, really changed everything. One was just that the place had turned into a really bad kind of hellhole. A lot of drug use, a lot of prostitution, peep shows, things that were, not that I have anything against, any kind of sexual activity anyone wants to indulge in, but it had become a place of really seedy businesses run by unscrupulous people and probably mobsters, although I can't attest to that. But of course, the other thing that happened was the AIDS crisis. And the AIDS crisis and Times Square's decline were in lockstep with each other. But by coincidence, I mean, one didn't cause the other. But it got to be such a sad, sad place. Everybody knew people who were dying. This was for like the pandemic. For a long time, there was no vaccine with AIDS. For a long time, there was nothing. I mean, there was you made people comfortable and you watched them die. And so many of our artists and Broadway workers, you know, there are tons of Broadway workers who are not artists, who are managers and advertising people, and they just got sick and they were all around you. And I very much wanted to cover that aspect of it. And then the rebirth of Times Square sort of, again, coincidentally coincided with the easing off of that crisis. So finally, by the 80s, you know, you had to look up and say, this has actually turned into a bad place, not a seedy good place. That's fun to. It's not Coney Island anymore. You know, it's really a bad place. And then, you know, through various agencies of one kind or another, Disney certainly being one of them, and the 42nd Street Redevelopment Project being another, that it really pulled out. And what it pulled out into is nothing like what it was at the height of its glamour in the early days. It became sort of more like a mall with a lot of places to eat and stores that were national chains. And, you know, the days of it, of its uniqueness, were over.
Yeah. I love there's a part in the book, I believe, where I think it's Ike's looking at the marquee and it's kind of being run down. He's just remembering, you know, I think it's something's happening with his braking or whatever it is.
And has it been banged into by a bunch of trucks, which happened. That actually came from an experience I had with one of our marquees. Trucks, you know, they just smashed into them.
That's crazy. Wow. But yeah, it was a great, I liked it. It's a simple moment in the book, but I enjoyed it. And that's why I remember it. Yeah. It's just, you know, he saw what it was and he can see what it's becoming. And that sort of thing. So what have you got in the pipeline? Is there anything you want to promote that you're working on?
Well, there isn't anything I necessarily want to promote at this point. The book has just come out and is selling really well. I'm frankly kind of floored by the fact that a lot of people seem to be interested in this book, but I'm a person who's a perpetual pessimist about everything. So, you know, when something nice happens, I have to reexamine my briefs, so to speak. I've just finished work as a consultant on the musical version of The Outsiders yesterday, as a matter of fact. The show is now frozen, and that's a job I do. It's a job I've done and that I hope to continue to do. I have one other show up ahead of me, but it's so far up ahead of me that it's not even really written yet, where I get hired as a consultant, creative consultant on shows like The Outsiders, which are based on, in the case of The Outsiders, based on a very solid and very popular book and a movie that followed, and are being created by composers, lyricists, directors who have absolutely no experience in the musical theater at all. So their talent is everywhere, but their nuts and bolts knowledge of how you write an opening number and where, you know, when the audience applauds and when they don't, what don't need to applaud, and all that. This is all news to them. I wouldn't even call it wisdom, whatever just experience I've picked up by doing a whole bunch of shows over the years. You know, I'm able to gently urge them to, like, try it this way and it may work better. And that has been a tremendously rewarding experience. I think the first show I did it on was Hairspray. Mm. I've done it several times since, and I'm going to continue to do it if I can. You know, eventually I'll just get too old for even that. But at the moment, there are so many young, talented people who have not done musicals or have not really done a Broadway musical, because Broadway has never been particularly welcoming to fresh young talent. It's always been, get me somebody who can get this show up in a 4-week rehearsal period, get it on, knows how to tech a musical. You know, I mean, you want people with that kind of experience so that you don't just go over Niagara in a barrel. But then eventually those people become, you know, people who've done it one too many times. So you have the old, especially coming out of Off-Broadway and the regional theaters around the country, you have all these talented people who are happy to get to Broadway, but they just don't have the experience yet. They're learning a new language.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting point I'd not really thought about. There's going to be a rise in that job position of, you know, guiding people who, you know, like you said, have not had any theater or, you know, Broadway or anything background, not necessarily know how to put it on and just need some kind of guidance.
And the other thing that goes hand in hand with that is that as producing has become more and more corporate, and there are now 5 million producers on every show, and even the lead producers are often people who either are corporate people or they're in the movie business or they're in some other business. Mm-hmm. They're not like Hal Prince and David Merrick and Kermit Blumgarden, who did a show every single year, and they got good at doing the job that I'm now doing. Yeah. But since those producers today are not that necessarily that equipped to do that job, and to interact with artists and all of that, it gives me another opportunity.
That's very cool. So, well, congratulations on the book. Like I said, it is a great read. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. It's a beach read.
Yeah. It, you know what? I did. I didn't do that. I just sat in a quiet spot and enjoyed it. And
good. Had a nice I'm read. Glad.
So the question is, where can people find it? I said brick and mortar and online. Is there any specific places?
No, that's true. It's just coming into bookstores and in some places where theater books are not the bread and butter of that particular kind of store, you're going to have to say to them, can you order this for me? Mm-hmm. But you also can get it online from Amazon or Barnes and Noble, you know, all the places that deliver books. It should be listed just by typing in the title and my name. The funny thing is I typed in the title last night and I realized if you go on Amazon and you type in Broadway Melody, the first 10 things that come up are all the movie versions, right? Broadway Melody of 1932, Broadway Melody of 1933. I finally had to type my name in to get the right listing.
That happened to me when I was doing research for the interview. I was like, oh, wait, okay.
Yeah, I didn't realize there were so many Broadway Melody movies. There were a whole bunch of them.
Exactly. Well, I really do hope it gets into the book and more the brick and mortar, because I love a physical book to hold on to.
Yes, I do too.
I don't know, but I still, you know what? I read it on a tablet with your book and I still enjoyed it. So I would have enjoyed it more if I had had it just as a physical. But
well, are you in New York?
No, I'm in Toronto. So
you're in Toronto. So I don't know the bookstores in Toronto.
That's okay.
In New York, you can wander down to the Drama Bookshop and they'll know what you're talking about.
Oh, for sure.
In Toronto, I don't know.
Awesome. Well, Jack, thank you again for coming on and talking to us. I encourage everyone to pick this book up and give it a read. I think they will enjoy it for sure. I know I did.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. And I appreciate being able to talk about it. And sometimes when you talk about it, you figure out things you hadn't figured out that you just wrote anyway. But, you know, it's a pleasure.
Exactly. Awesome. All right. We were just speaking with Jack Vitale, the author of Broadway Melody. So, yeah, make sure you check that out. Go to Amazon, or if you're in New York, you know, go to the brick and mortar and pick up a physical copy, because it's always nice as well. Tune in next week as we speak with another guest or guests about their life, love, and passion that is musical theater. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. And until next time, I'll see you when I see you.